Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Sometimes feel like the day is a bit hard to cope with. We hear you, and MeCBD can help. Research has shown that cannabinoids can have a positive effect on many conditions, from insomnia and anxiety to arthritis and chronic pain. MeCBD is organic, 100% natural, and vegan. Make a little me time with your cuppa and feel at your natural best. Visit MeCBD.com. That's MeCBD.com. Use discount code SPRING10 at checkout.
Hello, my name is Dave Hanrady and there will be no encore. Welcome to a very, very special episode of No Encore Podcast. It's the revisit in which we go back to a specific year between 1980 and 2005 and check out Irish albums within that time frame. The year is 2000. I'm joined this week, this time, by Brian Lloyd of Entertainment.ie.
Hello.
Michael Pope of The Galaxy.
Hello.
Colm Quirney, aka Q, a multifaceted instrumentalist who's been in pretty much every band ever.
Hello.
And Kieran McGuinness of Jalarento's fame.
Hello.
Hi.
Fame is
fame. Fame and fortune.
Yes.
What were the what was the fame and fortune in the year 2000, though, as our resident historian?
Oh, yeah. What happened in the year 2000? Okay, so the backdrop of these albums being released, I suppose, is the millennium, Y2K.
The millennium,
yes, obviously. George Bush was sworn in. Alec Guinness died. Aww. Blah blah blah, all those kind of things. Polly Yates died. Ian Drury. But in the Mad Cow Disease, which was terrible.
Oh god, yeah. Who could forget that?
Indeed.
And we had one short year to wait for 9/11, so everything was fine.
Oh,
amazing. We were just kind of hanging out.
They didn't know it at the time, but every album is pre 9/11. Yeah.
Yeah.
The biggest film of the year, American Beauty, but the biggest albums of the year were Eminem, Marshall Mathers, The Beatles' one album, Linkin Park, of course,
yeah.
Which influenced everyone, and Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again. But it was also the year of Kid A and Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea by PJ Harvey, which won the Mercury. So they were the kind of albums that were out at the time.
Well, will the Irish albums that we have contend with those? Can they possibly be as good as Hybrid Theory by Linkin Park? I don't know. I may have had that hoodie. Just want to put it out there.
You're wearing it now.
Yeah.
He's wearing it now.
I'll join you on that one. Very embarrassing teenage, like blunder years, 2000 to 2002. Yeah. Like hanging out with Asha. Remember, is Asha still there?
Is still there.
Yeah.
Shout out to Asha, not sponsoring this episode.
But they used to have all those like terrible like hoodies, like the Linkin Park hoodies and like the Metallica hoodies. And oh, it's sports. I'm getting wistful now.
Sport metal. Yeah. You know, lads in shorts. You know, massive guitars.
Well, jorts, I believe
jorts.
They call them.
Jorts. Yeah. John Cena-esque jorts.
Amazing.
Well, none of that describes the records that we're going to be talking about, which are the shortlist that we have this week, whittled down from a long list, is Damien Dempsey with They Don't Teach This Shit in School, U2's massive All That You Can't Leave Behind, the debut self-titled effort from JJ72, Bow Down to the Exit Sign by David Holmes, and Small Moments by David Kitt. Was it a fight getting here this time, Kieran?
Well, it was sort. It's a very long list, I suppose. I think around this period, like we did on a previous podcast, we did 1988, and we're kind of looking at, you know, between 15 and 20 albums. But in this podcast, you know, there was
big year.
There was like 30 albums, maybe 35, and a lot of them I actually couldn't find MP3s of, which I thought it would be easier as you kind of go on, you'd find more, like everything would be online, but some of them weren't, like David Holmes, which is one of the albums we're doing. Like, it took forever to find it. Eventually I found it on a...
Yeah, that was a bizarre...
a dodgy, yeah. dodgy Russian site. But it's weird that it's not on Spotify. It's weird that it's not anywhere, you know, if you don't own the album. And I just found that it's just weird. I presume it's something to do with licensing or something. Everything else, obviously, was online. But a couple of albums didn't make it, and...
Cores didn't make it.
The Cores, Brian.
Yeah, how
Brian.
About that? Yeah. What, I wouldn't mind, but like I really did listen. I went back and really re-listened to it. We're talking about Cores in Blue, and I'm really shocked that it didn't make it in. Just purely for the fact that like we've all got like these really worthy albums, and like we didn't have one trashy pop hit like in there at all. Nothing. Like,
well, this and, they, and their cultural impact was enormous.
Enormous.
Yeah, it was. I mean, like. Yeah, they were a phenomenon, and
they were a phenomenon. I had a teacher who took credit for them becoming the phenomenon that they became. A classic teacher who tells lots of yarns said that he met the struggling then Cores on a train, and they were like, he heard them talking. They were like, "Oh, what do we do? Like, how do we put it all together? It's just not going to work." And this guy walked over and he was like, "What if you take your trad leanings and mix it with contemporary pop stylings?"
Get out! <God. laughs>
And then next thing you know, biggest band in the world.
Yeah,
it's actually funny that the Cores were. I can't believe it's so long ago that the
they were huge.
They were massive. Mm.
Came back recently and, you know, still very popular. They don't appear to age, which is
terrifying.
Yeah,
well, that's it. They look youthful. Yeah.
And no one appears to have, which is rare for Irish circles, any contempt for them.
Well, I don't know one of them.
A lot of contempt in the room.
I wouldn't have like any sort of animosity towards. Like, it was like they did. They made like, just what you said. They made like, you know, contemporary music mixed with a bit of trad, and maybe it was so inoffensive that I wasn't offended, but it didn't bother me even back then when I was listening to.
It was just weird. I think like they were working with were they working with Mutt Lange on that album?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of had a sound of Shania Twain.
Shania Twain, very much so.
And weirdly, she kind of looked a bit like, and yeah, we won't get into that, the mix-up in the background. But yeah, there's the context as well of them being Irish and the kudos. Like, it's kind of tough to do that stuff with Irish leanings and be cool in Ireland. And then obviously it was... really successful then around the world because of the same reason.
They weren't Bewitched, basically. So there was a bit more credibility. I think the reason that this particular record didn't make it, though, is because Only When I Sleep isn't on it. And that song is ridiculously great to this
That's
day.
That's what it says on your hoodie. On
it
your
does. Core. Yeah. my core is emo hoodie.
And another one I thought, Sinead O'Connor didn't get in. That was, I think, one of her comeback albums, and it was... it was the very religious one. She was wearing the
that's what I remember the most. I remember like the artwork, and I remember kind of like, you know, the backlash to that, and a lot of people kind of being like, oh, you know, what's she on about, and, you know, should she be fusing these things together? But ultimately, yeah, I think it's an interesting record. It didn't quite pop for me the way some of the other ones did, but yeah, I mean, like, Sinead O'Connor is a very singular artist for many different reasons, and I respect the hell out of her for trying something different, but I don't know if the Irish public really took to it.
She's technically in the list because she's on the U2 album. She's
true enough.
What song is she on in the U2 album?
She sings on Peace on Earth.
The one with the lyric Gareth, Anne and Breda.
Do you know what else I was thinking? I was looking through all these albums.
Gareth, Anne and Breda.
And I think there's some of the lyrics.
Yeah, they're right. Yeah,
like
they're,
I'm a person who likes lyrics, I suppose. I always have them in my hoodies, and I just honestly, some of the lyrics and over the course of the five albums, I wouldn't be a fan of. But yeah, there's some funny lyrics on the U2 album, but there's some great lyrics on the U2 album at the same time.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. What kind of follow up it is to also to Passengers original soundtracks one.
Yes,
it's technically a follow up to that album.
It is.
And it could such not a be shame. So yeah. Weird or different.
Well, that was because that was. But anyway. Other albums that didn't make it on. There was a Frank and Walter's album called Glass, which is excellent.
Great
and there's a National Prayer Breakfast album, and I saw it there. You listened to it, and I
listened to it a lot back then as well.
I remember when I was starting out, they were kind of heroes of the scene.
They kind of were. Phantom FM. Patrick Frame was kind of like known as being kind of like as funny as he was talented as a musician and stuff like that. You know, it was kind of. And I think for a while they had to. They had to be called MPP legally. I think I heard this from my brother back in the day from the Phantom Day. Like, they couldn't be called National Prayer Breakfast because that was a cultural phenomenon in America, and they were getting in some trouble. So it had to be known as
What's the National Prayer Breakfast?
It's a political thing where it's like before an election or something like that. Like, all the nominees have to meet with like the Catholic Bishops Association or something like that. It's a bit. I saw it on an episode of West Wing. I mean, that's literally what
it's clearly a great name for a band. But they had to resort to the acronym NPB for a while. But they were kind of like for when we were kind of in our embryonic stage in Dublin as musicians. They were very well respected. They had some good records and they had some really really good live shows as well.
It's funny as well because there's a couple like David Kidd. I remember going into the Village. I mean, just as 2005 or something. I'm into the Village and they're like, David Kidd's here. You know? And someone was like, the whisper went around, and I kept going to the toilet, so I could look at him.
That is David Kidd,
you know. But the next level up was Kitzer's here. It was David Kitzer. Oh no, Kitzer is here.
Never saw Bono in the Village, unfortunately. But
did Bono, he ever? Did Bono? Bono
you never saw Bono and Mono, no?
Bono and Mono, no.
Dave, you remember Mono, right?
I do not.
No, you know. Well, before it was the Village, it was before it was the Village. It's Opium now. So before it was the Village, it was Mono. Before it was that, was the Mean Fiddler.
Yeah, I remember when it was the Mean Fiddler. All right.
It's called Mono for a while, yeah.
Mono.
Bono and Mono.
Yeah. You people.
Did Bono hang out with the Village? Yeah, I didn't know that.
No, I have no idea. All I know is that I saw a Joshua Trio there in 1999, and that was as good as close to Bono as it was going to get, really.
Joshua Trio, they were great.
Wilt also didn't make this.
That was your.
That was kind of my outlier. I think with Wilt, you know, I love their energy, and I think the problem with Wilt, though, is that getting through an entire album, it does get quite samey.
But remind me, so Wilt was a side project to some
Curb Dog. It was the follow up to Curb Dog.
Yeah.
And was it the same member? No, it wasn't.
Well, Cormac Battle. It was both. Okay. Yeah. I mean, like,
Cormac Battle had one like really big song.
On the Turn was their big record, which is very much beloved. I think they had a recent comeback and people were very happy to have them back. Wilt kind of had some songs here and there. They got a really cool song in the early 2000s called Distortion. I think it was on a FIFA soundtrack, maybe. But yeah, I mean, like, it's just kind of runs out of road. Like it starts off with a lot of energy. It's kind of like ash in a way, and then by the end of it, you're just kind of like, yeah, you know, this is all kind of blurring into one. And I think, you know, to put it in the top five, I didn't quite think it had the gold standard that we try and search on this here podcast. So.
Yeah.
But you know, fair play to the lads.
Hey, good show.
There's gonna be a lot of that coming around for this podcast.
Fair play to the lads, though.
Yeah, we're not here to offend anybody. But okay, let's get started with our shortlist. Okay, so we'll start with David Kitt and Small Moments, which sounds a little bit like this. You stand alone, so delicate. I said, that's fine, it seems right. Filling up the day again. Our bodies tied.
Yes, I was really surprised to actually see this on the list because it didn't feel that long ago, because every couple of years I dip into it and kind of find myself loving it all over again. Like, I mean, for me, that was the first time I'd ever really been introduced to something that was known as bedroom recordings.
Mm. Yeah,
when I was in a band in like the late 90s and stuff like that, it was, okay, got to get some cash together, the four of us. We have to go to the studio, record the drums, record the bass, you know, you do the overnight in some studios and stuff like that. You'd like, you know, you do everything you could to get that recording time, and all of a sudden this cat was doing his stuff on like a 4-track and an 8-track and making it sound really really good. And even if you listen to the intro of the album, it's like about a minute of kind of this ambient kind of weird
drone almost.
And then you kind of hear your beat come in, which still to this day actually sounds more relevant. Some of the loops and the beats in the album are a little kind of, they're kind of your Yamaha keyboard, you program it in. So they're a little goofy, but it's kind of
the appeal too.
It is, but it's kind of split in half, because you realise that a lot of this stuff, especially even how intimate it is, it's kind of ahead of its time, and in a way that kind of almost uncomfortably raw, numb kind of sound is very de rigueur these days. You know, you have like the stuff like Bon Iver sounds like he couldn't be more ripped open on, you know, but David Kidd kind of had that, like, where it was so intimate. And what I liked about it is, being someone who was not a singer, I'm not a traditional singer, like, my favourite singers always couldn't really sing, if you know what I mean. I was never really that into kind of like guys with mad falsettos or kind of stuff like that. I liked my guys who, like my Leonard Cohen and stuff like that. And I loved David Kidd's voice because it was so conversational and it was so, it sounded like if you spoke to him, it sounded like that he was singing to you even, you know? Mm. And I found I had a lot of really, over the last 15 years, I've become very averse or very kind of, I bristle at the idea of twee. And having your little brother sing on one of your songs, for me, nowadays, would be like, oh, come on. But I listened to it today. Again, and it's absolutely great. Gorgeous. And, and even I can kind of see that I think him and his brother kind of formed a band a couple of years ago. They were called, oh God, I can't remember. I know he has New Jackson, but the two of them had kind of a kind of thing. I saw at an EP a couple of years ago. And it was great, but normally I would bristle at that kind of thing, but I really, really loved it. I think the whole album really works as kind of like a kind of, he must be so proud of it, because I remember when Big Romance came out, he re-recorded, I might be wrong, but he might have re-recorded one or two of the songs, and I was just like, I deflated. I was like, it was just all so perfect. You didn't have to change anything about
it,
you know?
But I think it's really interesting. Like, you know, I mean, without getting too complicated, he's kind of put, you know, the electronic stuff underneath some acoustic songs, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, but it did make it stand out.
It really did, because he was kind of taken under the wing at the time of kind of the Frames and Mick Christie. He became kind of, people might think this now, because he'd be very much more in kind of like the kind of electronic, maybe kind of at the time, the Rednecks type thing. But at the time, he was kind of behind the bill with the likes of Damien Rice and the Frames, and I think,
Unfairly so, I think.
Yeah, and Mick Christopher was. I mean, I saw Mick Christopher and the Frames in Vicar Street. I think it was in 2000, maybe. And it was. Correct me if I'm wrong. He may have. You know, I'm not too sure. But unfairly. But I think that just the strength of the songwriting might have just been. You know.
Well, I think as well. Fundamentally, he was kind of like a folk artist.
Yeah.
That had this other skill that everyone else didn't have, which was that he was a great producer.
At the time, that was so unheard of.
And actually, probably, who knows who inspired who at that time. But the thing about this year is that actually we can see, and probably why there's so many albums, is that people are starting to make albums themselves.
Yeah.
And the whole idea then, well, if you're making themselves, well then making them yourselves, well then you also release them yourselves. Mm. And so it kind of promoted that whole thing. So he definitely had a foot, I think, in the folk thing as well. And I think, yeah, he was just an artist as well. I think people just respected what he was doing.
Yeah, I was as much into the idea of like, wow, I can't believe he put this together in his bedroom. Like, I started as a drummer and had my drum kit in there, and I'd set up a little dictaphone and just put it in there, and we'd get these horrible, smashed up, crushed recordings of me playing drum, just so I could sit up in my room on my guitar playing along to them. But he had this crisp, clean sound of like drum machines, and I know it wasn't revolutionary, but at the time in Ireland, it was like the bands were either live bands or they were extremely electronic acts. But to see this kind of hybrid, this fusing of the two, was exciting. It was even for. But at the same time, it managed to be completely intimate.
Yeah.
But that song at the end, the headphones, where he's like, you know, don't ring me, I've got my headphones on.
I've actually got a quote, because I think it just really encapsulates what's it. Don't try and call, I've got my headphones on. I can't hear the phone, I've got the headphones on. And it's like hits her. That's the line that absolutely, even thinking about that line, it's for all those goofballs who are having a spliff, who are those artists who just wake up at 11 o'clock and they just have the creativity kind of, you know, from 11 till kind of 6 in the morning.
Is 11 o'clock is late, is it? Or early? I don't know. It seems early for me.
11 o'clock at night. 11 o'clock at night. PM.
But how did you think he fared with his kind of live performances around, like you're talking about 99. I remember seeing him live as well. And obviously a lot of, like, you know, Mick Christopher and Glenn, they were all obviously very strong performers. But then Kitzer's kind of skills were kind of more in that kind of recording in the bedroom. I think when he was bringing it out then to an audience, I felt that, I think that was a challenge for him at the time.
It was a different crowd now. Yeah. I mean, I think we know as he's developed as an artist, he was maybe not quite meant for that crowd, really. Mm. And I did see him, I was a huge fan of the Frames and stuff, and Damien Rice way back then. I would go to all the shows and stuff, and he was always ever so slightly like a bit of a square peg in a round hole. It was unusual, because he, like, I mean, no one could doubt that Glenn Hansard could belt it out, as could pretty much most of them. Mick Christopher could, and so could Damien Rice, but Kitzer was just so hushed and intimate, and you know, it was like you would find that he didn't quite, he basically needed to find his own path. And back then it was like anybody who had a really, really good songwriting skills, which he did. They found themselves kind of getting blanketed in with the Hansard.
Come to the child.
But it's kind of not really one or the other, because, anyone who's like super electronic is going to be like, that's not real electronic. Anyone that's like, maybe, as you're saying, like big kind of folk, crossover act, like, is going to be like, that's a bit more bedroom, So I don't know. Like, I wonder if that hold him back or whatever, because I've never really, not that I didn't get into it, but it just sort of passed me a little bit.
Yeah,
probably
it
a little
did
bit,
me as well. Yeah.
Probably either a little bit too early or a little bit too. One sort of direction for me, not one direction, but you know what I mean. But the thing is that I listened back to it. Actually, I was really surprised by how good it was. You know, I've heard a lot of his more recent stuff, and not that I didn't like it. I thought it was very good, but I just never spent a lot of time with it. But this album it's just lovely. Like, I was sitting today, and I was running through. I just had them all playing in the background. I was playing with my daughter, and it's funny. We were playing with She was making a shop. I was buying grapes and things. And
making a shop. It's a Shopkins.
She makes a little shop. So, and then she has all little tiny little shop products. It's amazing. It gets me money out of it. Brilliant. Yeah. €2, Evan's €2. Yeah. But but she was sitting there and the music was on, right? And the sunlight was kind of coming in. I kind of felt like I was in like a scene from like an IKEA ad or something. It was all just, the music was lovely. She was sitting there playing, I could see dust in the air,
It's very layery as well. It just creeps up on you. It kind of, there's just layer on top of layer on top of layer.
Do you think some of the songs are a bit long?
I think there's a bit of padding. Because I think it's 8 songs in the whole album. And I would have done the same thing if I was like, I have 6 or 7 songs here. I need to make an album out of it, And, but it's incredibly evocative, though. It is.
It's very hypnotic.
It is him at 4 or 5 in the morning kind of saying, I kind of don't want to finish playing this just yet. And I think he captured it. He indulged himself, but it was his... As a debut record, it's really, really assured. He didn't have to do anything.
It's very accomplished, yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
But some people smoke, they don't make very creative, It's just that thing where you make something, this is amazing, and the next day you listen to it.
you think it's shit.
Yeah. But I think with him, it actually kind of really works. But I think a byproduct of that is that the songs are quite long. Because you just really get into it. And I think if you're on that trip, you just commit to it and you go, I'm in for 8 minutes, But also, I think it's very much headphone music.
It is, as he says himself.
It's for headphones.
It's an indulgent record, but in an okay way. And I think, words like indulgent and like precious, they're mostly used as negative connotations, but it can work.
It can work.
I do think you need to be in the right frame of mind, though. I think if you're at a desk working and you got your headphones on, you're probably not going to get through the whole album. You're probably going to get bored because you're like, well, look, I've so much else going on. Mm. But if you switch off to it, I think for sure, absolutely. Yeah. And it is, again, for a debut and for the method in which it was recorded, I think you could play this for somebody and say, yeah, this was his 6th album and you made it with this producer. And they probably go, oh, cool, yeah, I can hear that.
I don't think so.
No, Do you not think so?
No, I mean, when I was listening to it, I knew right away that this was done in a bedroom. And you buy into it, you buy into that intimacy of it. And even in the lyrics as well, it is very intimate. It's him talking very openly about relationships or whatever, and it's interesting. In a weird kind of way, as I was listening to it, it was almost like it was too kind of private, if you know that kind of way. It felt like he had. I don't know, we're talking about recreational drug use, but it felt like
we have talked about that a lot. We're assuming he was baked.
No, it's true.
He's never smoked.
But it is one of those things where he was stoned off his tits and he was really just opening up to you and I don't know if you want to tell me this, but fine, we're here now.
If you're listening, please let us know if this whole album was recorded at 4:20 a.m. and p.m.
I assume it's a very good album to listen to, though, while you're... What are we calling this?
He's the great thing, contextually, is that lyrically he's even he's telling us that he's doing that. And that's really wonderful. He kinda sets the scene and I don't know, it just sounds like someone who's supposed to be going to college the next day.
Yeah.
But they're just staying up all night.
And I like that.
And the kind of love affair you can hear the kind of love affairs, and that's what's really nice about listening back to these records, sort of 16 years, you're actually thinking about back to yourself being that age and different headspace you're in.
What were you doing around 2000?
I was making an album as well. I had released an album then, or it was the year after, but I spent 2 years on an album. And I'd left Lear, a band that I'd been in, so that was a very unusual kind of transition. I remember one of the interesting things that happened was that I spent such a long time making the album, writing the songs and arranging them, and And then when it came to releasing the album, my first gig was going to be in the Ruby Sessions.
Yeah,
the Ruby Session. And the last thing that I actually thought about that I needed to do was to be a singer and a performer. Or, you know, be kind of fit, like, as a kind of vocalist. I just thought, you know, it's just ticking off things, you know, things you have to do. And it was, like, literally just before I was to walk up with my guitar and sing the songs, I just realized, I don't know if I can do this, you know? Mm. But I remember giving it a bash and then just thinking, Jesus, back to the drawing board here. And so, but, yeah.
Well, from one David to another, and we'll go with a man who counts Steven Soderbergh as one of his biggest fans. David Holmes in 2000 released Bow Down to the Exit Sign, which sounds a bit like this. So, David Holmes, known to many as a very cinematic sound. What do you think he's up to here, Kieran?
Well, Dave. David Holmes, so Bow Down to the Exit Sign, his third album. It's funny. It sounds so like it's a soundtrack to a film. It's like, I had to look. Is there a film called Bow, you know?
But a lot of the stuff on it was used for albums. I would say films.
I looked it up and like
69 Police was the big one from
Ocean's 11. Yeah, exactly. That was on my note.
Oh, sorry.
But
stepping all over him.
That was my only note. No. It's atmospheric. It's got a lot of depth. I feel like it's a lot of stuff going on. A lot of different sounds. Sometimes it's hard to know if they're samples or if they're live. If they were recorded for the album or if they're parts of, you know, other songs. You know, there's a little bit of, there's a lot of trip hop, a lot of electronic, whatever you want to call it. There's definitely soundtracky. It reminds me of a little bit of DJ Shadow, the way, like, he has the kind of Black American voices kind of in it, and, you know, street scenes and, you know, songs about police and
soundscapes,
all that kind of stuff. It's mad. And the funniest thing is that, like, David Holmes, his name is on it, but you don't see David. You know, there's nothing about him. He's just in the background entirely. All his guest stars are right at the front. So, you know, Bobby Gillespie from Primus Green is on autopilot for two songs.
those ones.
They were the worst on it. But but the thing about it is he's got loads of, he's got, I think, Martina Topley Bird. It's all about the guests, nearly, you know, like, they're the people that kind of populate and the voices that you hear. And you hear very little of him, you know. But there's some absolutely brilliant songs in it, like 69 Police, that song, which you just said, it was from Ocean's 11, but that's an absolutely, it's just brilliant. It manages to sound old and new. Mm. It manages to sound like something from the 60s or 70s, and also sound like still like really kind of new sounding, you know? And then there's Compared to What. I have no idea whether that's all samples or it's live or what it is, but it's brilliant. And there's a song called Inside a Riot. And there, I think it opens with Compared to What and the other two are beside each other. And it's just the album kind of drifts between really grabbing your attention and kind of just being seen music.
Well, this is the thing. Is it a bit too loose? Is it a bit all over the place?
It is and it isn't. It's kind of a weird thing to say, because we're talking about albums and, like, you know, the art of what making an album, but it almost seems like it's not together enough to be an album.
Yeah, I think so. Oh.
But, like, or else maybe in the opposite way that you'd listen to. It's like a collection. It's kind of like
is it a collection?
It's a collection.
Is it
song.
An album that he made, or is it a kind of collection of things that ended up being put together?
I don't know. It's funny, but it's really good. Like, you know, I really enjoyed listening to parts of it. Other parts I didn't. Again, my musical barometer. I was having lunch yesterday with my daughter, beans on toast, and one of the songs came on called Outrun, which is like halfway through the end.
That's the one
Martina talked about, I think.
Slightly Portishead-y kind of.
And it's got loads of discordant sounds at the start, and Maeve was not a fan and she wanted me to turn it off and put back on Peppa Pig, whose album is actually very good. But the truth of it is that it is a bit all over the place and it is a bit kind of discordant and, you know, it's jarring at times, but it kind of works at the same time. So I'm kind of, it's funny, I don't know, I think, like, I always try and listen to albums, these albums a lot, you know, like, try and don't just give them, you know, cursory listens, like, have them on in the background, go for walks with them, you know, have them on when I'm on the dart and stuff. Just have them just in my life playing in the background. And this one, it never got deep enough under my skin, sort of, that I wanted to, I always felt like I was listening to it. Whereas with the other song, other albums, they all kind of grew in me a little bit. Mm. And I got to, you know, I wanted to hear other songs, I flicked forward to songs. Now, we did a little bit on this, but not to the same extent. It just didn't kind of get under my skin.
That's kind of despite the fact that it's trying really hard to get you to be immersed, isn't it? Like,
it's passive almost.
Yeah, with its samples and its kind of evocative sounds and kind of like the bits where it's like, is this a track or am I listening to kind of an audio? Like you said, and I feel the same way. Yeah, it's trying so hard to do that. That conversely, it fails sometimes. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then there's the whole thing of like, am I listening to a live recorded bass here or is this a sample?
Yeah.
That shouldn't really be a problem listening to an album if you like it, right? Mm. Surely, but as a musician, I'm like, you know, that sounds like a pretty crisp, clean signal he got from that bass guitar. That can't be a sample or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I think very much he was kind of, it's a produced album. He's the producer of that. It doesn't feel like he's the writer and artist.
Yeah. See, this is the big problem I had listening to it, or listening to other artists like this, maybe Moby or someone as well might be another example. Is that I find myself, the way I'm programmed and the way I got into music was by like looking at sleeves and finding out who played on the album and who's doing what and their contribution. I've just, like, listening to this has made me realise that even more. And maybe there's some sort of prejudice there or some sort of flaw in the way I kind of listen to music, because you shouldn't really be obsessing on those things. But I think also as well, the kind of music it is, some music you don't actually sit down and listen to it that way. Like you were describing, you kind of, maybe even like, you know, a lot of jazz as well, John Coltrane, you don't sit down and put your headphones on and listen to John Coltrane.
It's ambient.
Yeah, it's ambient. You let it wash over you and you do other things while it's playing. But interestingly enough, it's interesting that you said it still didn't seem to, even on that level.
That's
kind
just
of
me. But I do appreciate it, you know, if that makes sense. Like, I can appreciate it. And I go, that sounds brilliant, or the keys in that is brilliant. There's a couple of times on a lot of the albums where just little melodic bits, you know, like when you hear something, you go, that's just a new melody in the world. And you know, that's just a little perfect.
Where
melody.
Did it come from? I keep asking that question. Who owns it? And I know it's the wrong things probably to be asked, but that I think as a writer, I think my admiration is always like, that is a well-composed piece and it came from that person's being or something. But I have a hang up
about sampled work
I need help with that. Maybe someone could help me with that. I don't know.
No, I shouldn't have a hang up with it, but I still do. Like,
you should be going
every year. I go back and I go to those YouTube videos of like Daft Punk records and where all the samples came from, and I'm like, oh, you cheeky fuckers. I don't get high and mighty. I just kind of go like, oh, that's so cheeky, I can't believe they got away with it. Like, in almost admiration.
Yeah.
I actually don't have
but you're listening to it. Yeah, the fact that you're listening to it means
Robert Rock being the most
shameless
fucking
egregious,
yeah.
But so like, it's funny because like, and I, you know, three yous are musicians. Me and Dave are not musicians. You're not a musician, sure enough.
I play drums.
Will you? Okay, right. Well, well, I'm but, have no. I don't have
the Dave Hanratty Drum Collective,
Extravagant D, and the Big Band.
But like,
he was right in. He really plays. Drums. He was right in there.
Yeah, I was hang on, steady on, man.
All right, okay, we're fine. Well, like, I'm the only guy in the room that is not a musician. I don't have a fucking musical bone in my body, but I listen to a lot of music, like everyone in the room as well, but I don't have that kind of hang-up that I suppose you all have. That
there you go.
You're listening for, I want to hear this bit of music, or who did this and who did that and who did the other. You just kind of experience
it. Yeah, it's analysis. Yeah, it's a problem.
Exactly.
It is.
Yeah.
It can be a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of like listening to David Holmes, the album, what kind of hit me about it was that like I listened to it passively, and I mean that in the sense that like I could listen to it, I could do something else, I could write up a review, or I could, I don't know, clean my kitchen or something like that, or I could go walk my dog or something like that, and it would play in the background, and I could, as you were saying, like, there were certain parts of it that you'd like, oh, that's a really cool bit, I love that little piano fill, or I love that little, you know, that little soundscape where there's people talking in the background, that's really, really cool. And it's funny, because, like, it's weird, as I was listening to this, for this podcast, I started listening to Vaporwave again, which I know we're kind of laughing. You were saying that like it's such a cheeky shit, like that you're literally just like robbing something wholesale and just repackaging it. But I don't think that's the same here. I think with this, he was just taking smaller, like much, much smaller samples, as in like he was taking possibly like a little symphony fill yeah. from Lalo Schifrin or something like that, or from Bernard Herrmann, and then yeah. just like putting in like his own keys or his own bass line yeah. or his own drum line. And I think that is a bit more, you know, I don't think I'd call it sampling, but it's...
Yeah, he's taking inspiration.
He's taking inspiration, yeah.
Your point, exactly. your point is why it's so beautifully evident that his music was perfect for like stuff
films.
Like Ocean's 11, yeah. Out of Sight, you know.
Yeah,
I
mean, yeah.
Like it sits really well because it's not there to be, it's not like we're listening to John Williams or some Hans Zimmer score. We're there to be, yeah. it's kind of in the makeup of this slick, sleazy kind of jazz of a yeah. movie where everyone's just bantering and all that kind yeah. of.
And we don't need,
we don't need it to be.
Yeah, yeah, but also we don't need to kind of put it in that, you know, kind of pigeonhole as well. It just needs to kind of, you know, be what it is. Maybe that's why it's not available as an album, because he's probably yeah. not obsessed about this is my work. He probably just, you know,
I did it and here it is.
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he kind of had that experience and he's kind of moved on. And
I did think it was really one of the things about that was most soundtracky about it. If you're listening, I apologise. no, but just I know it's putting him in a box a little bit, but it sounded like New York, you know. It's like it's like he did a mind map with New York and he said police and yeah. he said hot dogs and he said yeah. this and that and the other, and all of the things click into it and it works in that the like sick city, all the stuff about the city, about New York, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And like I felt like it did, like it was effective and I admired it, but it just didn't get me, sort of.
Yeah.
Well, okay, from analytical nightmare David Holmes to another record that actually has some interesting words about New York. We'll go for a small-time indie band, U2.
Yeah.
And there underground sensation U2 and All That You Can't Leave Behind. This is Beautiful Day, which you've heard a million times before, but here it is again.
To take you out of this place, someone you can lend a hand. Turn for grace. It's a beautiful day. Sky falls, you feel like it's a beautiful day. To let it get away. On the road. But you got no.
So, Beautiful Day, I'm being criticized for picking that as an obvious choice, but the reason I'm picking it is because when I went to college, on the day of my orientation, they played
playing.
Beautiful Day,
oh,
and the guy...
The tears streamed yeah, down your face as you'd made it.
I realised I made my mistake, and whoever gave the speech, I don't even think it was the president, but he was like, I chose that song because it is a beautiful day. And I was like, fuck, really?
It was either that or like, cause I'm nearly sure it was
stuck in a moment you can't get out.
And I hope you guys have elevation in the course of your college.
But wasn't it one of those complete like Father Trendy, Father Ted albums, like that? As in, like your dad had listened to it, like, oh, that's a great album. That's a great album.
Fucking flabbergasted when this came out because I was like, honestly, stuff like Zaropa and
Pop,
Baby
Pop.
And Pop and Passengers original soundtracks one were like really my introduction into what the fact that you could be in a band and make electronic music as well. Mm. Now, I always thought those two were completely dissonant. I didn't understand that you could put together, despite the fact that people have been doing it for 25 years before that. But I was, you know, I was young and I was so into like stuff like some of the stuff on Zaropa, even the fact that they finished the album with a Johnny Cash song with just kind of a synth and a kind of little kind of a drum machine. And I was really, really looking forward to this album so, so much because I had been so into the previous decade's output. And I remember sitting in my bedroom with my then girlfriend, and I think we got to it might have been Walk On or something like that.
And you walked on.
And she just kind of looked over me, and I remember looking at, I was looking at, I was like, Anton Corbijn's photography is astonishing.
You fucking asshole.
I was like Patricia, they're in Charles de Gaulle, I think it's great. And then she just looked over and said, like, this is. It's a bit shy. I was like, no. But then the next thing you knew, as you were saying with that, I was like, what's this? He comes in. This is Walk On from you too. Oh, it's cracking that. Like, you know? And that was it. Like, but that's what I knew.
Well, yeah, All You Can't Leave Behind, an absolute monster of a record that kind of gave them, like, not that they needed a second life per se, but there was some people who were kind of, you know, like, oh, this
band's
best
of. A third best of.
Yeah, that's a good one.
There was a horrible quote from Bono who said this was their job application from, this was their job application to be the best band in the world again or something.
No, because this is the thing. He said, to be the biggest band in the world.
Sorry.
And then those people come in and say, why would you want to be the biggest band? Why would you want to be the best band?
Christ.
But the thing, like, you know, Bono we did a previous album on this. We did Rattlin' Home on thing. And it sounded like a very Edge record in that he was all over it, loads of his backing vocals and the live stuff. Ooh. You know, he was on the cover. It just, his guitar was so crisp and, you know, through everything. This feels like, I know they all are, but this is a very Bono record. Mm-hmm. He is just everywhere on this, and he dominates all the songs and all the, you know.
Is it the most front-loaded record of all time?
Absolutely.
It's that unbelievable. The first five tracks or whatever, and then all of a sudden it's just like, whoop!
It's just all the singles, and I think they might have done that with Joshua Tree as well.
I was discussing this tonight. It was actually Kirsten. 1, 2, 3 at the start is crazy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, once you get to Bull the Blue Sky, it gets a bit, it kind of starts to become more about, but the front three on, I think that might be the most top-loaded album I've ever heard.
And the unfortunate thing about that is the second half of the album, you're just going, never heard of this song, never heard of this song, never heard of this song. No, you know. So.
Well, that's what I was going to get. Like, no, Peace on Earth is on the album. It's not a great song.
Garrett, Suzanne, Anne and Breda.
Yeah, New York.
And then Reverses about saying Breda.
Oh, New York is a bad song.
Like, God bless them, they're not great. But the thing about it is it's a game of two halves.
Big time.
Yeah. And there's a song, like, I think Stuck in a Moment is just an absolutely...
It is a good
song. It's just an amazing song. And Edge's guitar is unbelievable. And you got to say, it is just... That's the song, you know, that I'll be listening to.
Well, it's the one that was about...
Michael Hutchinson.
So it was very evocative at the time, and I think sometimes
I didn't know it was at the time.
I didn't realise that until
It's interesting, isn't it, the context in which we kind of listen to music, and I think, and the context of the time that you're in. And I remember that just feeling like, every time I heard that song and thinking, I would just think about Bono's relationship with someone like that as a kind of very normal friendship. And and I think it comes back to what you're saying, the thing about this record, it's complete. The thing that Bono has, conviction. When he does have it, it's very obvious. Mm. And it's just, even when the lyrics are a little bit twee or a little bit, he's still like a 1,000%. Yeah, he's absolutely delivering them. Like, I have to agree with you with things like Elevation. You know, the lyrics. Who could sing that with that conviction? No,
it's not great, but there's a song called In a Little While is a lovely song, and there's a song called Kite on it. And they wrote that in the studio. They wrote that I read online. They wrote it at the time. You know, they just did it and sung it. And there's two vocals on it. Is it Wild? No, In a Little While, I think, and Kite. And they're brilliant. I just think, like, three or four tracks on this are among the best things that they've done. Mm. But unfortunately, three or four tracks on this are just not.
Even like the band had that kind of response. I mean, like the song Wild Honey, which no one seems to like apart from Bono. Yeah, could you? There was a lot of debate whether it should make the record because the fun and frivolity of the song was not something that they're noted for. Producer Brian Eno loved it and thought it was like a Van Morrison song.
It does sound like a Van Morrison.
And Bono wanted it on the album, saying it was playful and it broke the mood. Call it a sorbet between courses.
Come on now.
Speaking of Brian Eno, this was kind of the album where I fell out of love with Brian Eno's production style, not as a musician, obviously, or even as a thinker. I just couldn't believe the sounds he'd gotten out of even a rhythm section like Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton back in the day, because they'd be the first to say that they were not classically trained, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially Larry Mullen, they went off. I think it was after Zeropa, and they went like literally for drum bass lessons, because they had always just played he played the drums like he could play. Bins, you know, but in a great way. I grew up watching this guy. I grew up listening to his drum sound. You know what I mean? But they were never classically trained musicians. And I think when they went off and became better musicians, technically speaking, and I think they came back, and the drum signatures that I loved from that rhythm from Larry Mullen were gone.
Gone. He was clean.
He was clean, and he was crisp, and he just kind of, for me, he became less interesting as a drummer.
I fully agree. Yeah,
because like the stuff like. Even when my friend, we were watching a documentary, I think it's, you know, that documentary about the Berlin time with U2, and he was saying that Larry's kind of unique thing was that he could come up with drum signatures, like they were like guitar riffs, they were so good. And when you think of
which
stuff,
is a very difficult thing
to
do, when
you think of stuff like Bullet to Blue Sky,
that's
brilliant. That is a drum beat that belongs to him forever, one can even come.
And that 16s thing, not that he invented 16s and a hi hat, but. The way that he just kind of dished them out was
Sunday Bloody Sunday is iconic.
Yeah, that's it. But all those drum signatures died, and I think the interesting kind of musicianship. Edge certainly reverted to stock Edge sounds. Not saying that it's not incredibly efficient,
but it's the Edge signature sound.
Yeah, and it hasn't really changed since then. I do rue this album as being the time where this became the album to me.
It's the turning point, isn't it? I mean, like it's where you two kind of got safe. I mean,
it's face. Yeah.
But that's
free,
a lot of bands do it.
King's Leon right now. You know,
they get
to the
point
they don't care anymore.
Yeah, they get to the point in their career where they take everything that they've learned, and then they say, we need to, you know, because I think there's always that balance of a band of, I guess, you know, money success and critical success or whatever, you know, whatever way you want to say it. And, like, not that you two need more money or not, but I think they definitely wanted to be back in the charts again kind of thing. And they went out and they went on all the Top of the Pops and all those shows that were around at the time and whatever, MTV Live or whatever the chart show. They did everything around that time because, as I said, they wanted to just be back, you know, in everyone's ears again. You know,
it was a loving. Like, people really took to it. I remember, like, the Slane gigs. They had to do two Slanes because the demand was that. I'll never forget seeing a photograph on the front of the Sunday Times of a guy at a ticket booth banging on the window with hate on his face because he didn't get his U2 tickets. It was massive. This album was fucking huge.
But you'd wonder
if it's the album or if it's the kind of... I think there's a stage in a band's career when they start becoming nostalgic. And it could be like, and there's probably different reasons why that happened as well. There's probably other bands out there that might start to sound like them, and then they realise they can actually harp back to certain sounds and certain things. And so, is it the album or is it them just repackaging themselves and just being U2? Does the job enough for them to kind of?
Well, if they didn't have a trademark next to the name before this album, they definitely did it after it. Well, another band with a number in their name that didn't get to sell out stadiums.
Can't wait for this.
Didn't get to sell out stadiums, but...
I can't wait for Dave to talk about this.
Weren't really purpose-built for it either. This is October Swimmer by JJ72, a song that I fell hard for 16 years ago and still love now. That's the best song of all time there, October Swimmer. Where to start?
I just
I love that song. Sorry, Brian.
I felt like an air go out of the room the minute you said best song of all time. I just saw all three just move back from
but
the
see,
mic.
But see, this is the thing. This is the thing. JJ72 is like is a contentious set of numbers and letters. I put up a Twitter poll about this, and it seemed to be very, very in the middle where people stood on their self-titled debut. And I remember even back then, I remember buying this record at the age of 16 and being really excited about it and being a little bit disappointed with it overall, but I was still...
Really?
A little bit, yeah. But we'll get to the ins and outs of it in a second. But they seem to be a band that seriously divide opinion, and I think a lot of it has to do with Mark Graney's vocals, but overall, they're kind of a band that maybe shouldn't have been as successful as they were. It almost felt like it was never meant to be for them, and yet it was. There was just something about them that they were a little bit out there. But then a lot of people were like, no, they're just like a fucking cheap version of Radiohead or Muse or whatever. But it's just like it's a really fascinating case. But I think it is. But some people just think, no, shit. So
it's hard to overstate just how quickly it all happened and how...
What I was going to say.
How it's amplified they became so quickly and then how quickly it went to... Went away.
The songs were good.
Yeah, and they were. It was everywhere. The front of the enemy. I know that doesn't seem like a huge thing now, but back then that was a big deal. They're on the front of the enemy. That's it now.
I think was it Mark Radcliffe made them record of the week when October Swimmer got sent out, and for whatever reason, because a lot of people think that they are from the UK. Like, I was looking up, you know, a lot of interviews they did with like Drowned Sound and The Quietest and places like that, and even people commenting on them. People often lump them in. They always go, "Oh, that UK breed of this time," and they go, "Well, obviously, you know, your Muse is."
They big in the UK? Did they?
They were very big.
They were big, really. They absolutely have the album has such a UK sound. Like, it has that Mannix. I think they work with the Mannix
and Suede as well.
Yeah, and I think they work with the same producers. I remember seeing Mark on Top of the Pops.
Yeah,
and I remember just like the first time, the song started, and hearing his voice and like his look and his gait, and I remember just thinking, this guy's going to piss a lot of people off.
And he did.
And he did. And like, and actually what got me then was the lyrics. I just thought, wow, the lyrics are really kind of clever and intelligent. And actually I want to hear them again to kind of figure out what's going on here. And I thought there was, you know, I thought, and you know, he was a real screamer, like kind of Kurt Cobain. Mm-hmm. He could, like, not a lot of people can kind of consistently kind of sing like that, but it was a different sound that was coming out of his voice, and it was either kind of, it was kind of split, I think.
And it definitely did, but Brian, you're on board with this.
Yeah, definitely. Well, like, I mean, in the sense that, like, I remember when it first came out, it used to be kind of, it used to do the rounds on MTV2. We were talking about that before we came on. It used to be on MTV2 a lot, and I kind of dismissed it as, oh, that just sounds like Nirvana. That just sounds like Nirvana.
Or
that just
October Swimmer.
October Swimmer, yeah. It did. Like, it did definitely have a kind of a buzz off that. And Snow as well, I thought was...
I thought Snow was the song. I didn't know October Swimmer. And, yeah, go on. Amy,
yeah, but yeah, no, yeah, but no, Snow definitely, I think, had a bit of a suede, but it sounded derivative, is my point, is that it sounded very, very derivative. It sounded, yeah, it sounded like Mannix, or it sounded like Nirvana, or it sounded like whatever. And then a couple of years went by, and then I listened, this was about 2005, and I kind of re-listened to it again. Or no, not 2005, 2003?
When the second record came out?
When the second album
02,
came out.
I think, was the, oh, yeah, I think 2002 was the second one.
Yeah.
But as Mick said, it did all happen in a very short
time. Oh, God, yeah. Jesus, yeah. I mean, it literally, like, they came and went, like, yeah. It was literally just and then gone. But when I listened to the album again around 2002, I was like, okay, this is actually a bit smarter than I thought. Like, the lyrics were a bit more interesting than I thought, and you know, it became something more. But like, again, that was 2002, and I don't think I listened to it again since. I think it is one of those albums that it is very, very much of its time.
Very much so, yeah.
It has aged horribly, I think. I do think that. I really do think that. It's like, it's, you hear it and it's like, this sounds like it was made in 2000.
I know a journalist who said that he ruined Snow for her. he ruined the actual physical element of Snow for her.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Well, what about Informer?
What about then? Maybe, what about Oxygen? How does he feel about Oxygen?
Maybe she hasn't heard Informer. But yeah. I think it's an amazing opening three-track run. I think it's pretty heavy-hitting. It's October Swimmer, Undercover Angel, Oxygen. I think Long Way South is an excellent song as well. And
Algeria, best track in the album.
Do you think so? Wow. I mean, like, it's a bit of a slog to get there, but I mean, that one, Oxygen, actually, Mark did an interview before and he said that if he had filled his second album with Oxygen songs like that, he'd be playing the arenas that Muse later claimed. Which is quite the claim. He was also interviewed, there's a catch-up interview with him in The Quietus in 2005, and he seemed quite philosophical about it. Because, like, at one point in the interview, they note that, you know, someone had dealt with them before and was like, oh yeah, the drummer's lovely, the bassist's really nice, the singer is a dickhead, he's really up himself. And he seems a lot more grounded now, or at least then, that was 10 years ago. And he was kind of saying that, like, you know, you get into a taxi in Dublin and, you know, you got a guitar case with you or whatever. So the taxi man strikes up a conversation and he's like, what do you do? And he goes, oh, I'm a musician. And he goes, well, what would I know you from? And he's like, he mentions the name of the band and the guy's like, never heard of you. And he's like, do you ever, you know, do you know Bono? Like, you know, your classic cab driver question. And Mark was like, he goes, I hate this question because I always go, yeah, we actually supported you two. And he said that, like, at least one, if not more, taxi drivers have given him dog's abuse and been like, no, you fucking didn't. You know, like, there's just, I don't know whether, like, it carries over to him as in general, but there just seemed to be a bit of a weird, you know, like, here's a buzz band. Yeah, now they're gone and fuck off. There was just a strange, you know, it happened so fast.
I think
it was too much too soon.
I don't know if it was, I don't know if that was intentional in the sense that, like,
I think they did write it. That was far. No.
Was there a second album? Sorry.
There was. It's called Out to Sky.
I've never heard
of
it.
Yes, of course.
But there was a third album.
Which the record label.
But they sent it out, didn't they?
I think it was.
Because there's versions online of
it. It was made. Yeah, it's made. It was made, mixed, and mastered, and everything. But then a record label dispute with the Lakota Records, who I think was a Sony subdivision, he claims that, you know, that put paid to everything. And he says his biggest regret with the band is not taking 6 months, you know, or six weeks to 2 months off and just pausing things. That the band needed a break and never took one.
But this is what happens. Like, it's like, you know, it's like people's lives. You know, you can go on about, you know, if I'd done things differently, but the person that you are and the band that you are and whatever, you always make the decisions. You always would have made the decisions you made. You know, like, you know, there was definitely like, you can tell he's a smart guy, you know, and I do think it's a one head band. I think it's a lot of him. Tell he's a smart guy. He said he wanted to say stuff, but it does, as a debut album, it feels like the first step of something that was going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And it just sort of didn't. And, you know, you can go into a million reasons why that didn't happen, but I mean, it's on this list because, you know, it was one of the strongest albums that we thought. So I think,
I think it deserves. Despite my reservations, I am a fan of this record. I found it kind of going back to it. I found it quite tough initially, but it definitely settled on me. And I do think that overall, it's a little bit long. I mean, I'd lose a couple of songs, but overall, I think there's an awful lot. And for a first album as well, it is disappointing that it just kind of had a full stop not long after, because you're kind of like, this could have been great. To a different kind of poet, to wrap up these five, we'll go with a local legend, Damien Dempsey. And They Don't Teach This Shit in School, which sounds like this.
And when the baby cries, yeah, she has been criticized, yeah, been put down, if passed down.
That's It's All Good by Damien Dempsey. Cullum, talk to us.
Yeah, this is a fantastic album, really, as far as I'm concerned. It's a debut album. And I think Damien has spent, I think he's probably had an EP out before this, and he had Dublin Town. And I think he was afraid of that it was a bit of a kind of, had a sound of a bit of a parody or something of this kind of reggae Dublin thing going on. But yeah, it's a debut album, and it's actually just loaded with really, really strong songs. And I think one of the most, and he's basically introducing himself to the world, but let's say, you know, to Ireland. And the interesting thing is that I actually thought, because I'm from Kilbarrick, you know, actually live in Donegal now, and Damien's from Donegal, so I knew him, you know, a good 10 years before maybe this album was released, or maybe 8 years. And I'd seen him play and I'd seen him live. So I thought that what he was doing was quite niche. And I absolutely loved the stuff. And I would have been fearful for him that the stuff wouldn't translate, possibly.
You know, do you say niche? Do you mean that in the sense of like niche to Donegal, like to the north?
Well, I'm from Donegal as well. I felt the same thing.
Did you? And it was this kind
I
of nervousness.
We're all Donegal.
do we have a college in Donegal?
Well, no, I'm into Donis.
Yeah, St. Thomas. Well, that's, you don't get more hardcore than that. But
that's right.
So yeah, like he was. So I was nervous for him. But the thing about the kind of ironic thing there is that the album is about being standing up and being strong and expressing yourself and incredibly brave. And basically he reveals, you know, his things like, you know, there's a track called Jealousy, all about, you know, kind of being with a girl and being jealous and not knowing what he'll do if, you know, if he sees her with another guy. Incredibly honest. Another thing is his kind of republicanism.
Yeah.
Which is
so very, very on the nose with it. Yeah.
Yeah, and he just puts it out there and It's the way he puts these ideas and concepts across again is like with complete conviction, and I think he just kind of watching him then go on tour and play. Actually, that tour, to be honest with you, he was still pretty kind of low key because it was like they don't teach this shit in schools, like, so it's his first album, but actually I think maybe a couple of albums after that he's kind of still cherry. Because we're talking about legacy as well, he's kind of cherry picking a song here and there off that album, so he's kind of just kind of getting himself out there. But I have to say, retrospectively, like part of this legacy thing, when I did see him performing these same songs later, you know, as part of tours and part of albums that they subsequently were on, I couldn't believe that everybody with kind of open arms was going, "This is, you know, fucking absolutely amazing." And like, actually not being at the gigs, but more just like earwigging around or say being a Whelan's or hearing people, you know, "Have you seen Damien Dempsey?" And like for them, it was like the first, you know, unbelievable. And the way he'd written the songs are really folk songs. Ultimately, they're folk songs. They're like Bob Dylan songs, like in that, or Hank Williams songs, in that
there's also a lot of reggae in there. Which I think musically really shouldn't work, but it does.
Yeah,
sort of.
And it didn't work on that other song he had, Dublin Town. He was very kind of embarrassed about that. But it's very subtle on this record.
On this,
it's more subtle. Yeah, it's like,
yeah, that was the thing. Like, I went back to this record, because I'd never listened to it, so I'm going back after knowing Damien. Like, you know, when we started out, we played a lot of gigs in London, and Damien used to come to the gigs, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this was like 10 years ago, but he used to come to the gigs, and he'd be standing at the back of the crowd, and I'd be like, that's Damien Dempsey, you know? Like, yeah, it's mad, you know? Like, he was really into Irish bands, and, you know, he'd be, we've subsequently played a lot of gigs with him, and he's like a big, scary, gentle bear. Like, he's a big presence in a room, you know?
Yeah.
And we played in New York, and he played, you know, the Irish kind of songs, and they went mental. My wife sang with them on a song called It's Bad Time Garda, which is on this album in the Academy. And, like, the noise of the crowd singing back was nearly as loud as her singing into a microphone, you know? Yeah, like, it's mad. But the mix, like, as you say, like, it is, I think it is kind of niche. There's a bit of rap
isn't
in there.
Isn't it kind of like Blue Eyed Soul, though? I always kind of equate him to kind of like Blue Eyed Soul in the sense that, like, you know, like, you look at Blue Eyed Soul, like, average white band from the 70s, and they were all Northern England, like, you know, that kind of way. Yeah, and they took on soul as, like, their music. And for North Dublin, I think it might have been a bit of reggae and possibly a bit of R&B as well, which I think there's tinges of that in this as well.
Yeah, well, I'm always kind of deconstructing songs, but, for me, that would be the kind of musical side of it, and for some reason with Damien, it's for me, it's less important. Like, when I'm listening to it, it's the kind of epicness of the lyrics and the context. You know, he takes like the song Colony, it's a big epic piece where, you know, he wants to write his, it's nearly like, I don't know, Moby Dick or something. Like, it's like, I'm going to write about the Irish situation, I'm going to pour it all into the song, and it's absolutely going to be, you know, huge. So each title is like, there's so much packed into each title, title of the song. And again, it is this kind of folk thing. I think it's this folk thing.
I think, though, I mean, if you're going to talk about Damien Dempsey, you have to, like, sometimes I think, and I love the man.
Kier's head is in his hands.
No, I just sometimes, the lyrics would drive you mad, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think,
two on the nose?
No, I mean, just, you see, I think he writes completely from his heart, and I think, like, for example, I was in college, or I was in St. Donna's, I keep saying college, but I was in St. Donna's, and he's got a song called Factories, and I didn't have any, but that song is one of the most beautiful, like, it is literally, I think, one of my favourite songs, and I would walk up from, you know, the train, and walk up there, and, you know, see the sunset over St. Donna's. And it is goosebumps. The lyrics in that are incredible.
Because he's juxtaposing something so poetic with, not so only drab. Suburban. It's a drab, and it's kind of drab suburban. It's
I've stood on that, in Hope Junction, like, and looked out over and seen, like, the church, the kind of pyramid church we have there.
And that's not supposed to be romantic.
It's not, but like, there is, he's dead right. Like, however he might express it, when I come home, I go home once a week, and I go up and I stand on top of that bridge, and even if it's the grimmest day, I look out there, and there is something strikingly grimly beautiful about it. But then if you find it on a summer's evening, it's actually genuinely beautiful, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he just saw that and was way more poetic and expressive than I could be.
It's like he was telling us that we all haven't grown up in idyllic countryside, or like in social positions, but there probably is a moment, well, this one meant to me, there is probably a moment that you can hark back to in your own childhood when you were looking out over some sort of housing estate, and it was probably a very beautiful moment with the sunset, and I went, absolutely nailed it. I remember when I heard a song, I says, that is a very real
moment. No, I think he has an ability to connect with melodies that I think is just, I actually think there's very few in Ireland that do that.
You used the word earlier on about Bono, and, like, you know, when he has this thing, and the word is conviction. And I think that, like, the first time I ever heard Damien Dempsey was I heard Seize the Day. And my first reaction to it was, what the fuck is this? Like, you know, I'd never heard anything like that before. And once I kind of got over the shock of that, the shock of the new, it was like, he's actually great. He's actually really good. And, like, but also, I should hate this. And, you know, I think he can be representative for his community or wherever he's come from and the things that he's seen. But as you say, like, you know, Colm, it translated, and it's strange that it translated, but it has. And he's pretty much like on the whole, a beloved national figure who kind of has this certain level. And, you know, he mixes it up every now and then, not always to the greatest of success, but people fucking love this guy.
I've seen people crying at his shows.
Yeah, I actually have as well.
And no irony whatsoever. Mm. And I think that's incredible. But, like, the thing about me is I always think that I get really disconnected then sometimes by the lyrics. I just think, sometimes I just can't.
In what sense?
It's just sometimes, they can sound so
forced,
rhymey and basic, you know. Right. And they just drive me mad. And this happens on this album a lot. And I think that Dame Dempsey has written some absolutely incredible songs. And as albums went on, I think he's written better albums than this. And he's kind of ironed out that a little bit. I think this is him at his most, where the lyrics
new,
but on,
starting out
on this, I'll agree with you, but on this, he has like lines like, "Greed is the knife and the scars run deep." Now that's epic.
Oh no, right? I think it's and from song to song, you can have an incredible.
But I agree with you because then the next line may be something where you go, "Oh my god, that's so rhymey." And he just throws it all in together. But I think what you get in the bigger context is absolute honesty. And he's going, look, you're going to get some absolute killer lines, poetic lines that you've, you know, and then you're going to get some, but really what I'm talking about.
The Nelson Mandela line on this, for example, like, you know the Nelson Mandela line?
What's that one?
It's Nelson Mandela. I think it's what a lovely fella. Right, okay. totally serious, you know, and there's no messing. And like, the thing about it, like, I know. I'm
Conviction, Dave.
Yeah, but these five albums, like, you know, we've been talking about, there are moments, like, for example, one of the best set of lyrics is you know, on the U2 album Kite, I think is incredible, and it makes the hair stand up. And then there's other lyrics on that I think
are terrible,
It's the same with this album. There are lyrics, and it's sometimes, as I said, even in the same song, that are strikingly connective, and they make you just pay attention, what does he mean, or whatever.
Yeah.
And then... And then the next line is, you know, I vented on the bag, not the skag. And like, like that rhymes, but that thing of you don't have to rhyme everything just to make it work. Sometimes it's too easy to rhyme. It'd
sometimes I don't even know if he's being lazy. I think he just maybe wants to get it very directly out there. I remember thinking at one time, is he just being lazy? And I think, no, maybe he just sometimes wants it to be very clear. But I have to tell you one story. I did play with Damien Dempsey once, and it was quite interesting. I don't know if I should say this, but I'll say it anyway. He punched a lamppost when he was in London, probably when he was hanging out with you guys. It's probably just after coming out of your gig.
Our tech is called the lamppost.
But he punched a lamppost and he couldn't play the guitar, so he contacted me and asked me would I be his guitarist. So like, he was playing with the full pan, but the amazing thing was that I was going to be like Damo's kind of limb. You know what I mean? Like that extra limb. So he was standing there in his cast, and his arms all wrapped up, and I'm kind of standing underneath him, like kind of like.
Oh, he was holding the guitar.
No, he wasn't. But I actually, I'm probably painting this too romantically. But I actually felt like I was just there, you know, part of him, like an extra limb. So I was kind of, and he was telling. It was wonderful. He was like telling me what to do. You know, give it a bit of fucking gusto there. We need to fuck it, you know, get into it there, you know. And so I was like playing, and his guitar just felt like it was huge on me. But one of the most amazing things was, and he actually gave me a picture of this afterwards, and we were playing at the Donoghue Inn, and it was the first time he played the Donoghue Inn, and all
after his success, like.
After, like, it was about six years ago. So I think we'd done like three nights
great
there
or
two nights, and all we were thinking about, I think everybody was thinking about him singing that line.
So we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and try and pick a winner out of all these incredible records. Incredible for different reasons. Okay, so in our attempt to find the gold standard, which could be more than one, we'll start with Brian Lloyd. Brian, what's your shout?
I would go... Ooh... I suppose I would definitely go Damien Dempsey. I mean, after a little chat there, I kind of reevaluated it a bit, and yeah, Damien Dempsey and David Holmes as well. But that's probably just because like I'm a film critic, so like I respond more to film music maybe. But yeah, no, Damien Dempsey definitely.
Damien's your one.
Damien's my man. Yeah,
Michael Pope.
I just get one, do I?
No, you can pick.
As someone who, you know. You know, has been lived in Donoghue since he was since 1977, and lives on the train tracks, and you know, not literally, but like on a house beside,
literally on the train tracks.
He knows Damien by reputation, and also by the fact that he, like, in terms of what we're saying, that JD72 didn't have, which is what Damien definitely has as a legacy.
Yeah.
Mm. I will, if I can go for Damo and Kitzer, two dubs who really have a different ways of expressing themselves, but also kind of they both are still with us. Musically and creatively, and we're all the better for it.
All right, good.
Dave, who's
me?
On your hoodie?
Well, it's a tough one. I agree with what Brian said there and what Mick said and what everyone said about Damien Dempsey's record in terms of even kind of reevaluating it from that point. And I think that has to be up there. I mean, my own personal shout is JJ72 for all of its flaws and reasons and kind of weirdness and my own personal connection to it. But I think Damien Dempsey probably deserves to be recognised as...
So you're going for two?
I'm going for two. I'm going for Damo and I'm going for JJ72.
Okay.
I can see how this is going now already.
Okay.
Political voting.
Yeah. I am... this is Kieran, as Dave didn't introduce me.
This taste.
Can we just say Dave that bastard?
Yeah. No. You don't need an introduction, man. Kieran Delarentos, everyone. Famous Kieran.
I think that while the Damien Dempsey album is really good, I don't think it's the best out of this group, and not because it's not good, in my opinion. I think it's really good, but I think it's just... I think it's a really good... It's a good... I don't know how to put that any better than I just did. So I think David Kidd for me is the album I'm going to vote for.
Oof. Mm. Colin?
Yeah, I'm going to go for Damien Dempsey and I'm going to go for David Kidd. And it seems to me to be the year of the...
The David.
Of the... Yeah.
Oh no, jeez, what am I saying? Yeah. Damien and David.
Of the
sorry,
D's.
D's.
But,
two-way tie for first.
Yeah, it's kind of like the era, the beginnings of the indie, like, album. You know, do it yourself, make, you know, and also get out there and tour. And I like what you were just saying there, but it's kind of, it's interesting. It's a nice representation of the creativity coming from the north side and the south side. Mm. And, you know, two great albums. But I think I'd have to give it to Damien because... Legacy-wise, he actually went back to this album a couple of times and took songs. Like he'd done It's All Good with Sinead O'Connor for Seize the Day. He also done Colony again on Shots. So it's a very, very rich album. He'd actually been working on it probably for maybe 12 or 13 years. There's probably 20 songs or 30 songs that didn't get onto this album. We know debut albums can be very...
three debut albums on this, which is kind of interesting. Like that year... Yeah. People didn't go for the ones that, you know, there was lots of other albums on the list that were fifth, sixth albums, seventh albums for some people. And yeah. It was a load of the debuts actually were the ones that kind of came through for us.
Like. Yeah, well, it's just like, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a certain honesty from it and a certain, this is everything I've got right now. This is everything
I'm laying it all down.
Yeah, because it's like if your screenwriter, your first script has every idea you've ever had. Yeah. You know, and that's why a lot of bands and... But by extension, artists can fall down on their sophomore efforts. You know, they can be like, you know, well, I kind of gave you everything the first time around, you know.
Yeah, give me another three or four
story
years.
Of my life. Kind of gave you everything the first time, love.
The elephant in the room, though. No one going to shout there for you two? No?
You're on your own, man. You've been pushing this agenda since we got in here. You've been pushing you two
I'm
since
not.
We got in here.
I think that's a solid bronze medal, to be honest with you. So no, yeah. I wouldn't. But no, I think that's a fair result.
I think it's very fair, actually. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's. Are we talking like it's Damo by very, very by?
No, I think
it's finish. I think it's photo finish here.
Really?
Yeah, but I didn't split my vote, so he got 100% of my vote.
Okay. Kitzer did. Okay, and then
I went for two.
Okay, so
I think that's fair.
And I had 50% for Damo.
It does seem. Yeah, it does seem. It seems like I'm pretty happy with that.
That's fair. Yeah, we've had ties and they can happen. So congratulations to Damien Dempsey and
up
David
dubs.
Kitt.
Yeah, up the dubs.
We'll figure out some kind of prize that they can both share. Okay, well, guys, I shall wrap it up now. Thank you so much for all coming in and for shouting and, you know, being very pleasant and gentlemanly. That was good. So, you know, give yourselves a round of applause. Nice job. We'll be back with more Revisit and another year at some point.
Hello, this is Alan, the producer. Sorry to interrupt. It's just that Kieran got David Kidd on the phone, so we'll go to an interview with David Kidd first, and then we'll play out the episode with a song by David Kidd.
Hi, David. This is Kieran at No Encore. How's it going?
How you doing?
Good, thanks. We're just doing our podcast on Head Stuff about the albums to revisit from the year 2000, and Small Moments was one of our albums that we really want people to listen to. We think people should go back and listen to because it's a great album. So wanted to have a little chat with you about that. So I guess the year 2000, it was your debut. How did you get it? How did you kind of get into the recording of the album? Was it a long kind of 3 or 4 years writing it, or did it happen very quickly, or how did it happen?
No, it was kind of just an evolution of stuff I started doing, really, you know, kind of when I was 15, 16 with my first four track, and very much just kind of, you know, layering up sounds, trying to write songs so you could kind of have something to kind of just overdub onto, or and a lot of the stuff then maybe started as beats or programming something really simple. And you know, it kind of went from a four track to, I got a bank loan when I was in, I think, second year in college. I got a bank loan, bought a digital 8-track. And then in my final year in college, I was kind of recording most of Small Moments at home. And it was still at a stage where I was a little bit shy maybe about showing it to people, but friends were just like, just gone, so you've got to, you know, you've got to try and put some of this stuff out or try and give it to a label or something like that. And then around the same time, I was doing a few more gigs of, you know, kind of doing the kind of stuff that we ended up on Small Moments with a mini disc player with the beats, and then kind of playing guitar along to it. And that started, there was just a little bit of a buzz, and I started doing some kind of bigger supports around Dublin, and there was a lot of interest then from kind of managers, and all the kind of industry people started circling, all the kind of the wolves circling.
Yeah.
And I ended up going to South by Southwest in Austin, Texas in the year 2000, I think it was, or 1999. And I had Small Moments, like the 7 tracks of Small Moments compiled onto a CD to give to, you know, labels or whoever might be there. And I met the only person I actually gave it to was Jeff Travis from Rough Trade, and he got back to his hotel that night and listened to it straight through and said, "Listen, this is your first album. Don't change a note." You know, so that vote of confidence was, I suppose, a big thing. That was kind of how I felt myself. And there were a couple of people in Ireland who were up for helping out as well, like Leek and Dave O'Grady. And I kind of thought that if something didn't happen, you know, if the Jeff Travis thing hadn't happened, I probably would have gone with them. But it was, I suppose it was just like, for me, knowing the history of Rough Trade and, you know, even over the years, fully knowing the history of Rough Trade and some of my, you know, even just like Arthur Russell and Carl Craig and everything, releasing records with Jeff Travis as well. You know, just so many great acts being on the label. That was music to my ears, and that was pretty much how it ended up coming out completely unchanged. So it was very much like a snapshot of me before, like, you know, before you had any notion of really of a record coming out, you know, like that it would actually end up on a really big label and, yeah, you know, get pressed on vinyl and all that stuff.
The feel of it comes true, you know, there is a kind of a bedroom, there is a late night kind of feel off it. It's also, there's a kind of a lonely feeling at times, you know, maybe not a negative lonely, just that kind of in your own head kind of feel.
I guess that's just, you know, I mean, so many people at that age go through a lot of those feelings. While it can be quite a social time, and, you know, like, I think in a way for me, college, I thought was going to be this massive coming of age, you know, that it was all just going to happen. You literally walk through the gates and the kind of coming of age just kind of like happened naturally. And then you kind of start to realize, oh, well, it's just kind of like, you're still dealing with some of the issues of maybe not quite fitting in the way you would like to, or whatever it is. But, you know, it did happen, actually, as things went on in college. I kind of found my crew. And there's, you know, I think there's a bit of a sense of that on the record, too. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, there's definitely a kind of a... there's definitely a melancholy... at work in a lot of the songs. Yeah.
Well, it really works. One of the tracks that we were talking about, Sound Fades with Distance, You know, there's just a beautiful feel of that. You know, and it's kind of, it lets itself kind of, the song kind of happens like a lot of songs on the album. You know, it's over 5 minutes long. It kind of happens kind of slowly. It kind of lets the kind of groove happen. Did you remember anything about the writing of that song?
Yeah, a lot of the time it was like I would write the beats because I had this really old Macintosh computer that I got like from a friend at a family or whatever, and it was I didn't use it for anything other than Rebirth, which was a propeller head software which had a 909, an 808, and two 303s, you know. And I was coming out the headphone jack of the old Mac into my digital 8-track. So you had to kind of make a beat that was kind of like an arrangement and doing all the mutes on the actual Mac. So with that one, it was very much like I had a song loosely in my head, but I think what makes a lot of the beats on that record, like that one and There Are Words, be the same kind of way. They both happen in the same way. Whereas like stuff was shifting off the one and you had all these amazing happy accidents and then I had to play it to kind of meet those accidents, you know. And I think there were like, I was listening to a lot of Brian Eno stuff at the time and really into a lot of ambient music, like a lot of like Aphex Twin, stuff like that. Like a lot of the background stuff in it is, There's a lot of detail in that tune. There's a lot of bouncing and kind of just little bits of vocal and kind of stuff, like real headphone stuff. And then the song itself, I guess, it was a... I think it was early stages of a big relationship for me. And it's kind of like a... some kind of... There was a euphoria that was like maybe... of like early love combined with a like a legacy of a kind of a very typical late teens, early 20s kind of melancholy or something, and it's still a really special song for me, to be honest. I still play it live and there's some lovely little turns in it that kind of wouldn't have happened if the beat hadn't been so weird in the first place, you know. And yeah, it's just, I guess when you have to work that way and print things, you really have to kind of map things out in a very different way, and it's a different
way of writing songs to like sticking stuff down digitally.
Yeah, it really is compared to like modern Pro Tools or Ableton or whatever, you know. But
we were talking to another guy whose album was recorded. He only had a 4-track, so he had to record the bass and the drums at the same time with the bass on his lap while he was playing the drums. And completely enforced the sound of the album, you know, and it's a similar kind of buzz. Yeah, it's kind of different nowadays, I suppose.
It sure is, yeah. Well, you have to try. I think because I come from that world, I definitely carry that. I think I've ended up like in the last, like I went to the full on maximal 60 tracks on a session, and now I've gone full circle to back to kind of 8-9 tracks now. I really don't allow myself to have any more, you know, I think a lot of it does come from that early like phase of recording. Yeah, it just makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, cool. I mean, you've gone on to be, you know, super prolific. I think there was 7 albums or at least 5 kind of original music albums and maybe 7 full albums that you released in, you know, the 2000s or the noughties or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But so what are you up to now?
I am, I've got about 6 or 7 releases coming out this year, so it's actually, I've been working like harder than I've ever worked, to be honest, on music, and kind of balancing working for other people, you know, and doing as many gigs as possible, with just trying to, you know, find as much time to record as possible. But I've been last year was a lot of recording and a lot of it's coming out now this year, so there's a new David Kay record, there's a new Jackson record, there's about 3 kind of new Jackson EPs and a couple of other David Kay releases. Wow. So there'll be about 4 or 5 hours of music coming out this year, which is amazing. So it's probably at its most prolific at the moment, to be honest. And it's like, I think in terms of the actual recording end of it, it's about as healthy as it's ever been. You know? So yeah, it's good. It's not always like this, so I really appreciate when it's when it's a bit more straightforward, you know. Life doesn't get in the way and you kind of have a little bit of freedom to do some of this stuff. It's when you get the time, it's really, you feel lucky to have it, you know.
Well, listen, thanks very much for talking to us, David, and congratulations on a great album.
Toby, thanks, man. Cheers, all right, much for talking to you again. Take care.
Thanks.
Nice one, dude.
Come along in secrecy, you said I could, but I won't. Filling up with promises, our bodies lie, but we're immune. Thank you.
HPN, the Headstuff Podcast Network. See headstuff.org for more details.
It's all good. It's all good.
Nice. They'll make the outtakes.
Enjoy.
Thanks.
The order breakfast at the McDonald's drive-thru. Tell yourself you'll wait to eat it at work, but it smells way too good. So you eat it right there in the McDonald's parking lot meal. There's a meal for every morning at McDonald's.
Right now, get any size iced coffee for 99 cents until 11 a.m. and pair it with your favorite breakfast sandwich or one of our tasty bakery treats. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's. I'm loving it.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.